I've been coming to Bluestone for 21 years. And I've never had the privilege of chairing a meeting. And I think there was a reason for that, because I was saved for tonight. Every person on this program so far has been somebody that has helped me so much in my sobriety. I sponsor Connie, and I sponsor Mary, and I sponsor Kathy. I have gotten behind this podium many a time and chaired many a meeting, and I have introduced speakers. And I've said, I don't know much about the speaker. I just met the speaker, and that's not so with the lady that's going to share it with us tonight. In early March of 1979, I think it was, I got a call and from another woman alcoholic, and she asked me if I would be willing to go on a 12-step call with her. And I said I would. And when we left, we didn't know if we were going to talk to a woman in Al-Anon or if we were going to talk to an alcoholic. We just, it was Sunday afternoon, and we went. And we got there, and I met Marie. I can honestly say that I knew her when I fell in love with her. It was just like Mary just read, and I don't guess I heard that. Tries to help his brother alcoholic, who is even blinder than he. The kind of giving that actually demands nothing. And that's what that 12-step call was about. I met Marie, and all I'm going to say is take my word for it. She is one of us. I had the pleasure of sponsoring her when she was in West Virginia before she moved away. And I've had the pleasure of watching her grow, and I've had the pleasure of watching her sponsor other people and give away some of what she found. I can honestly say I truly love her, and you're in for a treat. I give you Marie from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
My name's Marie. I'm an alcoholic. Frankly, you can just stick a fork in me. I'm done. I've been up and down so many times. When Connie was singing Coming Home to West Virginia, and Gracie can save my life, and got some members of my home group here with me, and I know I'm never going to hear the end of this, because they're going to do something with these candles and spotlights now. I got news for you. I've been dropping things all afternoon. I've dropped cologne. I've dropped my toothbrush. I've dropped everything. And Charlotte came in, and my slip was hanging, and she dropped that. I mean, for those who, I have not been to Bluestone except when I was 9 months sober. And for those who remember that, I have not tried to take any cabs out of here this weekend. And I'm still with the Great White Hope. I want to thank the committee and Gracie, and I'm sorry the other speaker couldn't be here, but if I'm asked to go, I try to go, for the tremendous amount of effort it takes to put one of these together. And it's a lot of work, and it's a lot of sacrifice so that we can come here and enjoy this. I know I've been on several. I'm to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. And Suzanne, I'm nervous. I'm always nervous. And she got me a button. And she said, every time I got afraid to read this, it says, you will get through it. Just ask him. And that's what I'm trying to do, is ask God to help me get through this and to put the words in my mouth. And if there's one woman alcoholic sitting out there that thinks that maybe she can't not get better for whatever reason, then just believe some of us that you can. I came from an alcoholic home. Anybody that comes from one knows what goes on in one. And it was bad. And it was something that I had used over the years when I wanted to get people to feel sorry for me and to do all those things. I developed a tremendous amount of hatred for my parents. There were six of us children, and we all just kind of just grew up hating each other. My mother and father were both sick. My mother was sick from reacting to my father's alcoholism, and my father was the active alcoholic, and he would go to one institution here in West Virginia, and she would go to the other. And they just kind of took turns. To my knowledge, I don't know, and I've never heard anything that any connection they had with Al-Anon or AA, either one. But it was a bad situation. And I can remember being young, and I would think of how these different ways that I could kill them and get rid of them. And I started developing character defects at a real early age. And one of them that I remember so vividly that I found out as a result of my fourth step was the one of pride and the shame that I felt. I was ashamed of my family. I felt no love for my family, but there were times when I couldn't tell the difference. You know, it's hard for me to explain to you how I felt. It was like a love-hate relationship. And it got to the point that I just didn't care anymore. And my mother was the type of woman that she kind of was used to tell a lot of, I called them lies. I don't know, some of them might have been the truth, but it was always me against them. And I never felt ever like I was a part of that family. And that's something I'd always wanted, and I never ever found that until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But the way my family lived, it never got better. You know, my father always, you know, he was one that he had to drink. I understand that today. Back then I didn't. And I was I had that, perhaps that gene in me. I don't know. But I started reacting too like the rest of them did. And so I thought, well, I just need to run away from home. So I started running away from home. And, of course, they didn't catch me for a long time. But then I'd figure out ways that they would catch me, because I did not want to be where I was at. And I would run away, and the police would get me, and they would take me back. And so eventually I ended up in a juvenile detention center, and I loved it. I thought it was just super. And I thought it was better than where I was, but anyway, I got out of there, and they had several, you know, I had to go to hearings and all that. So finally the day came when I had my first drink when I was 13 years old, and it was moonshine. I don't know if they still have it now, but it was moonshine. And it tasted like hot grease. And I remember laying on this couch, and I drank this moonshine, and the whole room started spinning, and that's all I remember. I don't remember getting any big kick out of it. I just remember just going, you know, passing out, I suppose. But anyway, after that, I continued to sip a little bit. And then one time I was on a hayride, and they had beer on this hayride. And what we used to do would go around and steal drip gas. I mean, maybe, I don't know if they still do it or not. We did it in West Virginia. And but anyway, I was out all night long, and I remember I had to go to my mother, you know, excuse me, told me she's going to send me up the river and all that. And so anyway, to make a long story short, I was sentenced to a state reformatory for 2 years and 9 months. And I thought I liked the juvenile detention center. I loved this place, you know. Only thing I didn't like was, you know, I was called a farmerette. And they get you up at 6 o'clock in the morning, put you on a flatbed truck with armed guards, and take you out, and you'd work in the fields all day. And when you come home, you were pretty tired. So that part of it wasn't glamorous, but I loved everything about it. I got a good education. I made friends. And the day came when the superintendent told me that I was being paroled. And I remember kicking and screaming, and I did not want to go home. And I did go home, and I came back home, and it was the same way it had been before. Now, I can remember my mother's answer. I was 16 at that time, and my mother's answer was, she gave me a dollar and a quarter and said, go buy a six-pack of beer. And I had no trouble with that, but what I didn't want to do, I wanted to live there, but I know today that I wanted things my way. I don't think that when I really look at it, I think I could have lived anywhere if I could have drank. I really do. When I was there that night, I remember this disgust that came, that just washed over me. And somehow I had, by being in this reform school, gotten somehow my thinking. I thought I was above where they were. And I've discovered some of that this weekend up here. And I remember these rats and Daddy shoveling cockroaches, and I thought, I do not need to be here. Now, I don't know what you call a kind and loving daughter, but I wasn't one of them. You know, I wanted what was for me. But anyway, I went to this judge and told him I wanted to go back to reform school, and he wouldn't send me. He said, what we're going to do is send you somewhere else. And my life has been one extreme to the other. And what he did, they sent me to a Catholic convent. It was a cloistered monastery. And it's where the sisters would become novitiates, and they would take their vows and prostrate themselves on the floor. And God, I wanted to be one of those so bad. It was glamorous to me. The first night I was there, I ran away. And I went straight to another parish, and I remember vaguely talking to this priest, and they sent me home. And to make a long story short, I ended up getting a real good education there. I had very little to do with my mother, and my mother at that time would write me letters and tell me she was dying with leukemia. But she didn't have leukemia, but she had a problem with that. And then my father, he was still, everything was the same, so they decided that they could send me off to somewhere else. We had 9 graduates. And I remember one of the greatest moments of my life that I remember that I liked back then, was, there's not very many, maybe 5 or 6 if you counted them up, was they had a medal in this school, and they gave it to the girl who was the best girl in the whole school for 1 month. And there was a lot of students at this school. And I remember getting that medal right before I graduated from high school. And I thought that the whole world should know that. And by that time, I had really, you know, there were so many things going on in my mind that I was proud of. I was 19 years old, and this was a year later, and I was so proud of my virginity. I was a virgin. It never dawned on me that I've been locked up all my life, you know. That I may have had many, many children, but God does do for us what we can't do for ourselves. But anyway, I went to my aunt's, and I heard things like, you're just like your mother, and I liked it up there because I thought they were all rich. I really did. They had refrigerators and stoves and things like that, and clean sheets. And Joe tells me that I desecrate watermelon because I used to have to pick it out of trash cans. He said, don't tell that in your story. You make watermelon sound bad to everybody. But that was part of what happened. But anyway, I got up there, and things didn't go so good. I guess I wasn't the center of attention, and I guess perhaps a potential alcoholic. That's used in the book, and potential lasted probably 2 drinks. But somehow I got, my grandfather had a big nightclub up there, and I remember every time I'd go into that town, I'd prop on that bar stool, and I'd just, you know, have a beer, and I'd feel so important because, you know, at that time my uncle owned it, and I just took off with that. I thought that was really something, and I thought that I could just stay there forever, except I had to live with this aunt who was not fond of me at all. But anyway, I found a pint of bourbon or something, and I got drunk, and we had a lot of trouble that night. We had enough trouble, they moved me out of town to another town that was several miles from there, and told me they wished me all the luck in the world, and that's where I ended up. But anyway, I stayed there, I got a good job, and I got it in my head that probably what I need to do is join the convent. Now, I'd been partying the night before I made this decision. And I remember it was a real snowy day, and I had my boots on, and I went, you know, traipsing through the snow to this monastery and talked to Mother Superior, and she said, didn't take her long to diagnose me, I don't think. She said, Maria, my dear, my name was Maria then, she said, whenever you find your place in this world, she said, you come back. And God, so many times, I mean, and that does stay with me because I know that I have found my place in this world, and it's in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm a drunk, and I'm grateful I'm a drunk. And I'm a drunk that's been allowed to stay sober because of people like you in these rooms. But anyway, I came back. Nothing up there worked. I mean, it was a terrible time in my life. I spent my whole weekend locked up when Kennedy got killed. And, you know, I had this thing for Dr. Kildare, and I had his picture on the wall. I was just lived in fantasy. You know, when Dr. Silkworth talks about being full flight from reality, that's what I was. You know, I did not... I had to live up here. I couldn't face and deal with reality. And I started drinking up there a lot more than what I had. I came back to West Virginia, and nothing had changed. Now, the image I had of myself, I'd been up there a while. I'd been in school. I graduated. I got good grades. And I remember coming home in a taxi, and I had a long coat with a little fur collar on it and gloves and a little pillbox hat. And I felt like a mini Jacqueline Kennedy. And I wanted to go home, and everybody proclaimed that I had just changed my life and brag on me, and none of this happened. And this cab driver, I said, take me, you know, gave me the address, and he said, lady, you know, that you got the wrong address. That place is condemned. Nobody lives there. And I said, you know, well, of course, and it's this house over here. And I walked in some strange woman's house and could have got my brains blowed out. I had a thing with that. I've had a bad sense of direction. And anyway, the cab driver did, they did live in this place, and it had been condemned. It really had been. And later, when the porch fell in too, it made the front page of the Charleston Daily Mail, and I know that pride I had. I just, you know, I was so sick at that time. If I could have had a bomb, I'd just blown them all up. I mean, that's just where I was. That's just that pride and that over inflated ego. But anyway, I got it in my head that what I needed to do was just to have a baby. And by the way, when that porch caved in, that's when we found all the, I just looked like hundreds of Solox paint thinner cans, because that's what my father drank. He couldn't afford wine, and I guess he was just a regular wino, but he liked his, God bless him, his Solox paint thinner. But anyway, I thought, well, if I have a baby, everything will be okay. That's all I need in my life. It's just something to call my own. And I remember I went out with a girlfriend of mine, and we stopped at this place, and it was called the, I don't know if anybody here has been there or not, but I have to tell it how it is, the Ponderosa Drive-In. And there was a fella there, and he was in this old 50 model Ford station wagon, and we later named it Sky King. And he had a tooth out and a black eye and drunk and on crutches. He'd been in a fight and all this. And he looked at me and said, I had pretty brown eyes, and I got pregnant and married, and that's just how it went. And it just was not a working marriage type thing. He did had real problems with working and other women. And it's never to my knowledge, he just, you know, he did stop drinking, but he doesn't have a program or anything, so I wish him well in that. But anyway, I truly believe that I was a lot sicker than he was. I mean, how many women take out and lay out all their socks that they bought and cut the bottoms out all of them? I mean, I did stuff like that and rip up stuff. And anyway, we had two children. When I was pregnant with the second child, I remember that's when he put me in jail one time for assault and battery. I had made myself a little maternity dress, a little hat that matched. I looked like Little Red Riding Hood. And he did something. So I remember calling this cab, and I said, take me to a nightclub. And they took me to a nightclub, and it was, well, it was called the Old Corral Club, Grace. And which was a bad place. And I remember going in there, and I ordered myself a big drink, and I drank it, and they sent me home. The guy knew me, and just all heck broke loose when I got home that night. And because I don't know what he did, but he locked himself in the bathroom, and I took a hammer and something, and I beat him out of the bathroom. And anyway, he got a warrant on me. And the police came by, and he was out there holding my little girl, and he said, now, they said, we're not going to take her to jail. I just looked so proper, you know. And I said, oh, yes, you are. And they did. And I spent the night, and I was so sick in there. I mean, I was pregnant and got in that elevator, and it was just, at that time it was sleazy, you know. And I remember thinking that was a bad decision, you know, that I told them to take me to jail. Later on, I got comfortable with that jail. You know, I got to know several people. I remember one time I was in there, and Maria will appreciate this, and I was always trying to play this rough and tough person, and they threw me in this cell, and there was a large black woman in there, and they were taking her out of my cell, and there was three eggs on this bunk, hard-boiled eggs, and I wanted that bunk, so I just threw them in the commode, you know, and I remember saying, what is she in for, because I heard them say that on TV, and they said they're transporting her to another institution. She just stabbed her mother to death.
And I got those eggs out of that commode, and I shined them and polished them. And at that time, you would have thought I laid them. They were beautiful. But that's kind of how I went into those places. But anyway, we ended up separating. We had two children by that marriage, and that's how nervous I am. My watch is here, and I'm looking here. And things just didn't work out. I remember I had a little sister, and one morning the TV was on, and her picture came on there, and they said, "Have you seen this child?" And I got in my head that something must be wrong, and I went up there, and she had been taken from the home, and it was just a murder and rape and all that mess. And then my father, 21 days later, well, he told me at the funeral he was going to kill himself, and he always talked that stuff, and I said, I didn't believe him, but he did. And I lost the baby, and my brother got killed, and all, another one got shot down, so I thought, what I need to do is go to work in a nightclub. And because I just, you know, at this point in my life, I said, heck with it. You know, I said, there was just, you know, my little brother looked up at me, and he's 10 years old. He said, am I next? And I thought, well, either him or me, one of us, you know, so might have something to do with that fear I had, Brenda. But anyway, it got real bad, and I thought, well, there was a club there in Charleston, and they were advertising for bunnies. And I thought, if I could just become a bunny. Now, I knew what Playboy was, and my mother-in-law had come and gotten the children. I had the two little girls, and one was 5 months old, and the other was 3 years old at that time. And they never came home. Anyway, I thought, well, what I need to do is go up there, and I was just as ugly as homemade sin, and but somehow I got the job, and I felt like the first lady of bars, you know, and I had my fishnet hose on, and I had my Calypso tops, and I got pictures to prove it. I work with newcomers, they'll say, yeah, but you never drank, And it got to the point where this is basically where everything started happening in my life. By the time I got here, it didn't take a year or two, and I despised myself. I absolutely loathed who I was. If I could see another human being on the street and they had said, if you'll cut off your right hand, we will make you like that person, I would have probably done that. I wanted so bad to be like other people, but I was not like other people. You know, I know that today. I can remember Gracie telling me early on, Marie, the only thing that'll ever kill you is if you think you're different. But I always felt different, and that's why I drank. I wanted so bad to be like other people. I'd hear these girls from IBM, they come in and sat in our club, and God, I hated them too. You know, they were ladies. And they sat there and they talk about they were going to take a look at this or take a look at that, and I said, well, God, don't they know who they are? I didn't know anything. I knew I had a social security number, my name, and I had a job. And if I was lucky, I had this thought a while ago, and I don't mean to bring anything bad into this, but when Gracie was saying how many's been here this amount of years, and they go 13, 14, you know, it just clicked in my head. Now, if she's talking about men, I could raise my hand. How many have you had? You know, just keep on going right through the whole thing. Because that's what I would have identified. That was my quest in life, to see how many men I could be with. And how I know that after I sobered up, that there had to be some of those guys that probably did care. You know, but I was the type that I ran. I was terrible with relationships. And when I married early in AA, and I'll tell you about that, and I don't recommend it to anybody. Jesus, it was the hardest time of my life. You know, there were times when I just walked around in utter misery. But I know today that I have to have a relationship with God, then myself, before I can ever have one with anybody else. But anyway, when I got into this club situation, everything just gradually just turned worse. You know, I started I was in the Charleston General Hospital, I think, about four times, and it was always put me on that third floor. That's the psych ward, you know, for if you're crazy as a bat. I remember one time I committed myself to Highland Hospital to see what was wrong with me. None of these times did any of us ever discuss drinking. Although every time I went to jail and ended up in the hospital, I would be drunk. And they were always trying to get at the source of this or the source of that, and it had nothing to do with alcohol. You know, at least today, I know that drinking's not, alcohol's not my problem, but I had to reach the point, I had to admit that I was an alcoholic and find out that I had a disease, and somehow, it just didn't come up. But anyway, I got out of there, I had 4 suicide attempts. I was one of those alcoholics that whenever I wanted to kill myself, I took a bath and I fixed my hair and my makeup and I called everybody in town and told them, you know, just in case something happened. And one time I almost did it. I had gained a lot of weight, out there drinking and carousing, and I reached a point where nobody else would hire me in the bars. And they wouldn't say that, but I got the idea. I remember going to this one bar I went to all the time, and I asked them about a job, and they said they were selling it. And I mean, they weren't selling it. They did not want me to come to work there. And I remember going into bars, and I would go in, and everybody would be so nice to me, and I'd think I was so popular. And I found out later that it wasn't that I was popular. It was just simply that if they didn't speak to me, I would create such a ruckus that and tear up the joint and end up going to jail. It was just easier for them to tell me a lie and say, hi, glad you're here. You know, and that's kind of how it went. I remember having one true friend towards the end, and she did stay with me to the end. And I don't know where she's at today. We've lost contact, but nobody would hire me anymore, and so this woman asked me, and it's another extreme in my life. I've been a bartender and in bars for a long, long time, and she asked me to come to work for her, and I did, and this was at the Black Diamond Girl Scout Council. And it got embarrassing down there when my own insurance reports would come in. You know, possible OD had been drinking, and I'm out trying to organize the cookie sales up front. I mean, it just got, it got bad, and... And so I stayed there a while, then she went on to another form of part of state government, and then at that time I went to work for education, State Department of Education, and I liked it there. But all the time I was there, my drinking was getting worse and worse and worse, and then finally I went to another division of the government, which was a special unit that they set up. I don't even remember what I did. I remember I drank. And I remember going into the ladies' room, and I would take the top of the bottle, the lid off the Cepacol bottle, put my foot on the commode so nobody could hear me. You know, and then I'd get in an elevator, and they'd say, what's that alcohol? And I'd say, it's that mentholyptus. I always had a cold because I had to have something to tell them. And then one day I was up in Wheeling, West Virginia, and something happened. You know, I was up there, and I was in the chamber office, there, and I started just shaking, and I remember making an excuse that I had to leave, and I remember going downtown, and I asked this total stranger where the liquor store was, and he told me, and I went in, and I got some vodka. I was a vodka drinker, high bottom right to the very end. I didn't have anything else, but I had vodka. Loved smearing off vodka and beer. I think that's all was in there, wasn't it, Russia? Anyway, we got up there. I was to meet her for lunch, and I met her for lunch, and she came, and... I remember I walked in and I had like 3 double Bloody Marys. I mean, I went downstairs and I drank some more just as fast as I could drink it. And that's all I remember. I was always her driver because she had trouble driving. And she ended up that day driving me back to Charleston. And that was to be, God willing, the my last drunk. And I think today that I am sober because I have never forgot my last drunk. And I have people who can constantly remind me of my last drunk. And I had always had, anyway, I was standing there and I had a hide a bed at this time. My sister had some surgery, and I'd seen a movie called The Days of Wine and Roses. And for some reason, I always stayed glued to that movie. I liked movies that had to do, I guess, with people like me in it, but I didn't know I was identifying with it. And I remember, and I'm one of those drunks that if there was a preacher came on TV, I would go over and I would cry just as hard as I could, and I'd pray to be saved and all that stuff. Anything for that temporary relief. You know, there was a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous that I envied, quote, Christian people. And I mean, that's a generalization. They had something, and I didn't have it. I couldn't find it. I was struggling. I didn't realize that I was on that journey. That trudging that road of happy destiny. I wanted so bad to have the peace that you people had in these rooms. But anyway, it got to the point where I told her, I said, called my sister and I said, call AAA. thought it had three letters. And she did, and it was really frightening later when she and I, she told me what I had said to her over the phone about the condition I was in and where I was at. But anyway, the next thing I know, I had a high to bed, and I was hallucinating. And I had a big piece of wood, and I was knocking on it, trying to figure out how to fold this wood up to put it in my high to bed. You know, now, I know you can't fold up wood, but at that time, I thought you could. And the next thing I hear is some loud woman, coming up the steps, and I heard her say, "Al-Anon, hell, this is an alcoholic if I ever saw one." And that lady was Gracie and Sue. And I have very little memory of that. I thought that I had cleaned up, you know, again like I always did before anything happened. And but Gracie later told me that it looked like someone had combed my hair with Vaseline. And somehow before this drunk, I always liked to go around and do a lot of shopping. And I thought, and my taste at one time was like red fake fur sofas. Crazy stuff, you know. And I bought this hot pink nightgown. And it was just pink, you know, pretty. And big block letters all the way down the side of it. It said, "Baby, light my fire." And that's how Gracie took me to detox. And I remember going to detox, and they got me, I remember being in a wheelchair, and I remember, these are my first thoughts, someone handed me like a canning jar full of whiskey, and I'm thinking, they're not supposed to give me that here. And they said, "Drink it." And I thought, this is all right, you know, I stay here forever. And then a physician come in, or somebody, and I remember asking if they were an alcoholic too. I just thought everybody I came into contact with was like me. And I had a tough, tough time in there, you know, and they called it a mild case of DTs. And if it's mild, I'd hate to have a bad case. And I remember some of the gals, and I assume it was Gracie, I don't know, I just can't remember. They said, talking to me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I'll go if you don't force me to go. And they said, "We're not going to force you to go." And then they came time to go to the meeting. And they said, "We're ready to go." And I remember thinking they were forcing me to go. And they said, "We're not." And I think they turned around and walked off. And I said, "Well, if that's the case, then I'll go. I wanted to go on my terms. Is that alcoholic or what?" Anyway, they took me in, and I was just so embarrassed. It was a clinic-type setting, and there were street people there. And I was in my pajamas and this wild house coat. I was just, you know, I thought they just treated me. It was, shouldn't have done that to me. They were publicly embarrassing me. And I remember a guy talking about his Jeep being up in a tree and how he should be there, you know. And I also remember at the end of that meeting, there was two big men on both sides of me. And when they started that Lord's Prayer and they took my hand, I tried to get out of there. And I didn't know the Lord's Prayer. You know, I did not know the Lord's Prayer. And it took me forever to learn the Serenity Prayer because that just was not where my thinking was. And later, there was a girl that came there a couple days later. She brought me a big book, and I think she had some trouble after that. But anyway, I still have that big book. The message had been carried to me. I got out, took my sobriety date. It's March the 8th of 1979, and that was on a Friday. My last drink was on a Wednesday, but like typical, I wanted to be sure that alcohol was out of my system. And I remember they came to get me that night for a meeting, and I remember them saying they didn't know who I was. You know, I mean, I just shook for 30 days. I could not put makeup on. I just shook that bad. And I remember going to the meeting. I remember they took me down to a meeting in Dunbar, and my first impression of Alcoholics Anonymous was, you all didn't really care about me because all you did was sit around the meetings and talk about yourself. And then God forbid somebody asked me to talk. And I told them everything. I started telling them about my sex life and all this crap. And somebody kept saying, "You don't tell all that in the meeting." And this is what I remember, you know. I'm real trusting up here. I know if any of it's wrong, Gracie will correct me after the meeting. Then a fella came up, and it was George came up, and he was saying, "Now, Marie, you're an attractive girl." And I thought he should have said beautiful. Well, we all knew it was neither one at that time. And he said, started telling me about the he and the she, and it goes on in AA, and I just thanked him and went about my business, you know, and thought, I just had a real problem with him at that time. Because anybody was, you know, anybody, I wanted to be like him throughout my first early years of sobriety, and I couldn't do it, so I just resented you. You know, that was my problem up here. I just resented everybody because you were sober, and I wasn't sober. I wasn't drinking, but I wasn't sober. Anyway, that night they took me to a meeting, or after they took me to breakfast, and at breakfast I remember spilling my milk or something. I just started shaking real bad, and nobody paid any attention to it. They just simply acted like it wasn't nothing, and I was so relieved because I just thought, oh, God, I've embarrassed everybody. But anyway, I got home that night, and I got a phone call from another well-meaning member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this guy was also 13 years sober, and I remember him saying, would you like to have someone come and watch TV with you? And my God, what an answer to a prayer. And I said, well, of course I would. So he came up, and I remember telling me my story of woe. And I remember him telling me about Dr. Bob and Bill and early AA. And, you know, boy, you know I was comprehending all that, don't you? You know, first meeting. And I've told Gracie the only way I can describe it is I got everything I needed through injection that night. You know, just all poured in there. And later on, for the record, he and I became, we got together and we cleaned up some things there and ended up friends. But that night, you know, that night, it was not a good idea. So if there's any new women here and a man comes knocking on your door or calling you and wanting to help you, tell them to hit the road, honey. They're not interested in your sobriety. They're interested in something else. But anyway, this little relationship went on, and at that time, I think I had been appointed the temporary sponsor, and of course, that didn't work out later. I just had a lot of trouble with a lot of things. And I remember one night coming out of a meeting, and I had Mr. AA on my arm, and had my tight pants on, and my spikes, and my silk, or probably polyester blouse, and I just, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks sober, something like that, coming out of a tape meeting, and I remember he ducked down and started playing a little game, and I ducked down too. I didn't know what it was, but the game was that his there was an ex-wife there, and she'd taken 6 shots, you know, and I'm sure they went over my head, but when I came up, raised up, there was a yellow car, and this gal had a gun, and she told me in no uncertain terms what she'd do if she ever caught me again, and I swore to her she didn't have to worry about me. But I ran, and I ran the wrong way, and she caught me. And I remember hugging this brick building, and I thought, you know, there was a club right down the street that I hung out at. I wanted to be at this club because it was one of the places to be. And I remember going to this club or thinking I can go to that club or I can, you know, go on home. Finally, she let me go, and I got to a phone, and I called a cab, and the darn cab driver didn't want to take me home. I told him somebody was shooting at me. Anyway, I got home that night, and this is how sick I was. He had beat me home, I think, and I just remember telling her if she got some help that I wouldn't, you know, everything would be fine. Now, I'm out with her ex or whatever husband, and I'm telling her things that might help her. That's how sick I was. The woman, and I always say, at that time, I'm sure she was not a member in good standing of Al-Anon or had a little bit of trouble that day. And by the way, today I do have many, many, many friends in Al-Anon. I can remember for years I had 3, then 4, then 5. By the grace of God, you know, I've had a lot of help. I really have, especially from Virginia M., from Charlotte. But anyway, I got through this, and I remember at whatever point in time I called Gracie because the day came when the rejection came. And now I'm going to meetings, and every time I'd go to a meeting, I'd be filled with anger, and I would, you know, I'd run up to every cute girl I saw and say, watch out for him, you know. I do not, by the grace of God, know how I stay sober through that whole time. But I remember calling Gracie, and Gracie told me, you know, she said, we'll go to a meeting. I remember them taking me to a meeting in Parkersburg, and I remember that drive back. I remember there being a lot of church steeples, and I remember it being a lot of stars out that night. And I'm thinking, you know, all this time I'm in AA, I don't really know what's going on. I just kind of follow everybody. You know, I kick and scream, but I still do it. I still go. And I remember thinking, God, if all those people believe in something, why can't I believe in something? Why can't I, you know, there's got to be some truth to something. And this was when I guess I was coming to some kind of terms with finding God. But anyway, I started, I was a member of the Edgewood group. And, of course, I just didn't like anybody in that group. They were all sober longer than God, and they all had had their ways, and especially when I couldn't get attention in that group. And I remember one night that something happened, and they had made me secretary, and I remember putting up my hand and telling them that I was resigning from the group, and I was resigning as secretary. And I remember Al F. just said, "Not now, Marie," after the meeting. And I hated that man. I hated him. I was just humiliated beyond words. And then, of course, going down the road, and I do not recommend it for anybody, but I got married. Somebody told me today it caused quite a stir in Charleston. I didn't realize that, thank God. But anyway, it was on. You know, I knew nothing about nothing. And by the grace of God, we had celebrated our 12th anniversary last August, and I attribute that to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe that it's worked because I have wanted to stay sober more than I have wanted to drink. And I love the man that I live with today. I just love him. I love what Isaac said of Millie. I love him, I guess, as much as a woman can love a man. And I didn't have any of that. I didn't know how to do that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. But I put that person through 3 years of hell. Probably more than that, but three that I remember. After then, I started getting a little better, and I said, it wasn't that bad. I remember the love I got in my group. I remember Gracie and 12-step calls. I especially remember being in Gracie's apartment at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning and looking at her and say, "Gracie, will I ever have anything like this?" And she would talk to me, and she'd show me Lois's picture, and she'd talk about Bill. And God, I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. I loved everything about it, but you were not going to know it. But she knew it. You know, I know today when there's somebody in our group and they're kicking and fighting and screaming, and yet they keep coming back, they want it. You know, and like when I came to this when I was 9 months sober and I hated everybody here, I was dying inside. I didn't know how to ask you, how do I become like you? And I can remember the love that was given me here. You know, and people, I love what Johnny H. says, that loved me enough to withstand my wrath. They didn't take abuse as such, but they loved me. And they told me to keep coming back. I left Charleston, and when I was 1 year sober, I moved to Myrtle Beach, and I hated it. There was no buildings like I thought were buildings, like they were in West Virginia. There were no mountains. Everything was flat. It was just terrible. It was just terrible. We moved down there, and it got to the point George and I both went broke, went bankrupt. And I remember him working in a greenhouse, and I went to work stocking groceries in a grocery store. And I would come home, and I would say things like, "I didn't get sober to live like this. Hell, I never had it so good." And I'd look at George and I'd say, "And what are you going to do about it?" He said, "We're going to go to a meeting." And we traveled a long ways to get to because we lived in the borderline of North Carolina at that time, and we went down to the beach. And all this time I had such tremendous fears. I mean, fears that I'd ask people, "Do you ever have fears like I have?" And they'd say, "No." And I'd feel, "My God," you know. Then one time I went to George, you know, my great white hope, and I said, "Did you ever have the fears that I have?" And he said, "Marie, no, I didn't." And I understand what the book talks about, was chased by 100 forms of nameless fears. I didn't know what to name them either, but I had them. And I can remember all the time I couldn't drive in a car at night. And if I got 10 feet away from anybody that might help me, I just went into just delirium. I was just that afraid of everything. I had a tough time sleeping. It was 18 months, I think, before I ever really got a good night's sleep. And I was making my rounds with the doctors. You know, I mean, it was embarrassing one time, and we had to go to this doctor to learn how worrying about yourself can make you sick. And here I have my new husband, and, you know, I'm finding out they're saying I was like a hypochondriac, like one. See, I'm still in denial, but I'm better today. I had my checkups this year. I didn't call one doctor back to see if I was dying with anything, you know, because I did it. I make fun of it, but I had a tough time with it. And I reached a point where I told George one night, and this is why I understand and know, and I found the steps out the hard way. And I told him one night, I said, I think I'm going to have a nervous breakdown. And he said, you're scaring me. And I pictured myself going into, like, the bathroom. You know, they talk about you going in that room and there's no doorknob on the inside and you stay there. I just thought I was going to start just laughing hysterically and never coming out of it. And I remember that night, he said, Marie, you can't hold a negative thought and a positive thought at the same time. And the only thing positive I knew was one word, and that was God. And I laid there all night, and I said, God, 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 until I went to sleep. The next day, it seems like when I'm willing to go through these things and accept them and do something about them, it's almost like God rewards me for the effort. The next day, I got a letter from that daughter I hadn't heard from in years. I'd heard from, but there was no, you know, well, we didn't have the contact. And it was things like that. And I can remember on down the line when I've had a tough time with the third step, and I was about 4 years sober, and George again came in, and I said, I go to meetings, and I had talked to Tom G from Canada, and I just could not understand this third step, and I was one of the ones that somehow missed doing it with somebody in the book. And he said, well, let me show you what it's about. And I had written this letter on a piece of paper at 4 years sober saying, why can't you give me what you've given those other people in Alcoholics Anonymous? Why can't I feel? And the whole thing, when I got done, I counted 32, me, myself, I, all to do with my total self-centeredness. I saw it because George had told me what to do with step three, and we got down on our knees, and we said that step together, and I felt embarrassed, and I felt ashamed. I had all these emotions, but there was an inner excitement. You know, because I was starting to understand when I did that letter and I wrote it, as hokey as it may be, you know, you find God how you do, I find Him how I do. I wrote the letter to Him. I don't know if He's going to show up at my front door with the answers or what, but I wrote it down and I saw the bondage of self. I saw what it had done to me. And I believe that I'm allowed periods in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm allowed periods of sanity. You know, and I had been restored to sanity. And when I got to this part, I can remember when I was doing my fourth step. And I remember when I found the shame, I found in my fourth step that I didn't even like my own children for fear they didn't like me. I didn't like anybody. I just literally felt like the hole in the donut. I looked around at everybody and all people would do such nice things for me, and there'd be times when I couldn't feel gratitude. I would have that selfishness of they should do that. You know, that's their job. They're sober. They should do that for me. That's how sick I was, and I am not proud of that. But that's where I came from. And I can remember going to this priest and telling him what I wanted to do with my fifth step. And I had my list. And I made this appointment, and I went in there, and he said he had a big book on the shelf. He said, yes, I understand what you're trying to do. And I went in, and I told him, and I went through the whole thing. And I had one, I mean, if I ever kicked a dog, I wrote it down. Or anything I ever did, it was some bad stuff in there. And I remember when I got done, he told me to destroy that could be very incriminating. We didn't get down to the exact nature of my wrong. You know, he told me, he said, if by chance you accidentally give you the wine in church, you immediately stand aside. I don't want your picking up a drink to ever be on my conscience. He knew I was a bad alcoholic, but he didn't know what to do for me. And I remember for 5 and 6 years after that, people in meetings would share about the freedom they found with the fifth step. And I remember feeling I didn't have that freedom inside. And I know it now, it was because I did not get down to the exact nature of my wrongs, and I found it necessary. When I was 8 years sober, I went through a bad time. You know, I don't know about you, but I enjoy speakers who I can identify with, and I especially identify with those that have trouble in sobriety, because I had trouble in sobriety. And probably, God will, I might have it up the road, but at least I know what to do about it. And I went into a place in sobriety that I walked around with this tremendous fear. It all came back. And all this time, I'm thinking I'm doing all this stuff I should be doing in AA, and what you saw I was doing. You know, I was working with girls, and I was going to meetings and going to conferences and doing what was asked of me. And then somebody told me that I loved dearly, told me the difference between action and activity. I was into nothing but activity, and I was taking no action on myself. And I didn't know that. I did not know that till somebody told me that. And I had to get busy, and I took another fourth and fifth step, and I couldn't get my sponsors, so I chose a member of my home group that I trusted, you know, who was active at that time, and they heard my fifth step. And I remember them looking at me and saying, well, Marie, I believe what you're saying is, now am I good enough for you? You know, now will you accept me? And I didn't know that I had to accept myself for who I was, and I had not done that. You know, I had not done that. And Alcoholics Anonymous, you have given me something that no matter what happens in my life, I'm allowed to look at. And I can find an answer, but I can't do it myself. You know, I have to do it with other people. And I can remember one time in our home group, I went through a thing where I was just feeling like, I don't want to be here. You know, and somebody wasn't listening to me or something, or it was right and I was wrong, or whatever it was. And I remember, you know, I remember talking to Millie, and Millie was telling me things like, well, by God, if it, don't go screw up another group. Stay in there and work it out. And I've had to do that, you know, and I can look back and how they didn't allow me to screw up the group in Charleston, West Virginia. And that's what it's about for me, is staying sober, and I am a member in good standing of my home group. I wanted to tell you about my daughters. I have a daughter, two daughters. One is 25 and the other is 23. And one just got married, and she spent her honeymoon at our house. That's by the grace of God. And got the cutest little husband you ever saw. I mean, he's just precious. The other one has a granddaughter. The granddaughter's 3 years old. She's pregnant again. I've never seen the granddaughter. Haven't seen her in 10 years. And that I have accepted today. You know, that I don't like, but that's where it's at. But then in Alcoholics Anonymous, I work with a girl, and she has a baby called Lindsay Marie that I sponsor. So I have a grandchild. I really have a baby. I let her have it occasionally. I know there's been times in Alcoholics Anonymous when my gratitude has just been zero. And I know I've gone up to people and I've said, have you ever lost your gratitude? You know, I lost my gratitude. I didn't lose it all. But when I was in this bad period of time, I reached a point where I didn't want to die. I didn't want to live. It was kind of like those thoughts I used to have when I was out there drinking on the street. You know, and I found out that in Alcoholics Anonymous, people are not going to feel sorry for you. If they love you, they will not feel sorry for you. And I get tough love in my home group. And they don't care if you're 8 years or 18 years sober. They will tell you the truth. And they tell you that with open arms and a lot of hugs and a lot of kisses. And I can remember this one time when I was having trouble with my relationship with my darling husband. And I can remember our sponsors were down, and I can just remember blowing it all out in front of them and how it all worked out in the end. Today, I don't have to take any problems of mine that I usually create. I love what the book says. It says, I must be careful not to deliberately manufacture my own misery. Because I can take a solution and make a problem out of it. I can create problems when it's been smooth for months. Because that's just what I do. I remember Gracie telling me one time, I said, I don't understand this. And many times since then, I've heard her say this. When everything's going so well in my life, I start thinking, what's wrong? You know? And it's learning how to live with some degree of serenity. And if there's nothing going on, that usually I would create something and make a big mess out of something when it didn't need to be. You know, today, I don't have to go out there today and I don't have to drink. And I wake up in the morning with the same man. I have changed how I've lived. I came in Alcoholics Anonymous and I was quite trampy looking, I think. And I remember getting the little hints on how to dress and mannerisms. And you people literally transformed me. You know, I'm standing up here tonight and I've got some clothes on. And I'm decently dressed. And when I was drinking, I never had. I mean, it was just live for the moment. And in AA, I want everything Alcoholics Anonymous has got. And I want it all. You know those t-shirts that says, I want it all, Santa? I want it all in AA. And I know today that sometimes there's just bad days in sobriety. And I know when I look at people like Al and Gracie and Coca-Cola John and Viola and all the people in this room, I know they haven't had it easy either. And when I work with newcomers to come in today, I get so excited and enthusiastic over what's going to happen. You know, the precious times are ahead. And the times in AA have been good to me, and they've also been bad. But the bad times, when I got through them, it was 10 times better on the other side. And I guess what I'm trying to say is today I'm more willing than I've ever been in my life to stay sober. And getting sober has been the hardest thing I've ever done because I'm not there yet. You know, I have good days, I have bad days. Because the AA, it says we have a design for living that works in rough going. And I need that. I need the 12 steps on a daily basis. You know, the reason I stay in trouble sometimes is because I don't continue anything. I think, well, I can look at the 10th step today and then I won't have to do it for a couple of months. That's, I don't consciously say that, but that's what my actions say. My 11th step, it's been everything I can do to try to take that extra time for me and God to rid my mind of my thoughts and think God-like thoughts. I have no trouble with going on a 12 step call. I have no guilt there. If that phone rings, I go. Or I want to share it with somebody. Somebody else, I don't need to take all the 12 step calls. It's my job to make sure some of the other ones get some. But I have no guilt in that area. Gracie, had she not showed up that day, I might have said, they don't care either. And she saved my life. When I mean she saved my life, she got off her sofa and gave up her Sunday afternoon, and she came to help me. And who in the world am I that I can't go do that for another drunk? And I have to watch getting cocky in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why no matter where I'm at, I make sure there's somebody there a hell of a lot more sober than me. Because I'm an alcoholic and I think like one and I like to run things. You know, well, I belong to a group that don't let me run nothing. You know, they love me. They love me. And I just hope that I'm going to say this and I'm going to sit down because I started talking at 20 after and I have orders from sponsors to sit down when your time's up. That if I almost hurt for people, and I know there's some there who don't have a sponsor like I had, and I don't mean this bragging, but the love that I've experienced from Gracie and Marion and Brian and people in the fellowship, and I belong to the finest group of Alcoholics Anonymous that you'll ever find. Basic tradition. If it's not Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't talk about it. We just don't talk about it. And we discuss the traditions, and we try to make that newcomer feel welcome. And if one comes in off the wall, we tell him we love him. If he shows his butt, he has to go outside, but we'll be outside with him after the meeting's over. And I am so grateful for the home group that I have in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, because it's something that has carried me through from the time that I left here and bounced around for 3 or 4 years down there. I have a home. When Connie was singing that song tonight, which was absolutely beautiful, coming home to West Virginia, this is so special to me up here. It is so special. I have to tell you this. I am a tough one. It's hard for me to make amends. But I felt such incredible love out there tonight for my husband. I can't believe I said this and I meant it. I'm sorry for every rotten thing I ever did to you. This is what this place does to you. I have to live with that when I get home. I just can't. It's the emotion. The emotion that's here, and the people that knew me when, and no matter how many curse words I said or how sleazy I looked, they never gave up on me. They said, you'll be all right if you want to stay sober. Wesley P. said that to me one time. He said, maybe you just don't want to stay sober, and that's why I got so mad, because I did, but I didn't tell him that. Later, I was able to. And I just want to personally thank each and every one of you for helping me find a way to live, and it's only just beginning. Thank you.